Now comes the good part. I get the opportunity to introduce our speaker tonight. One of the things, one of the great blessings about coming to Ridgeview and joining the Alumni Association is get to start to go to meetings that are on campus. One of the meetings my sponsor had me go to very early on was the detox meetings. And a little over 4 years ago, I was at a detox meeting and this lady walks in and she doesn't look like she looks tonight, as you'll see. She looks gorgeous. She put together well. She wasn't so put together when I met her. I wish I'd have taken a picture. I don't know much about makeup, but I think the eye stuff is where the lip stuff was, and the lip stuff was where the eye stuff was. She was trying. But one of the great blessings is you get to see people come in this program, and you get to see people get sober, and you get to see people blossom. And every once in a while, you get to see people really do this thing the way I think it's intended to do. And this is one of the ladies that has done that. And I've had the catbird seat and the privilege and the honor of being able to watch that happen in her life. Even through, so she's had some recent, I'm sure she's going to tell you about it, some recent loss in her life, but she handled it with grace, and she handled it the way that I would hope that if I went through some tragedy in my life, I'd handle it. So I want to introduce, just tell us her story tonight, one of my really great friends, Jen. Come on up and tell us your story.
Whoa, there's a lot of people in here. I'm Jen, I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me okay? That's the first thing. Let me take this in, because there are a lot of people in this room tonight that have saved my life and continue to save my life, and I'm just now seeing you guys. So I love you very much. Let me get that out of the way. Joe was saying, you know, one of the key parts of my sobriety over the past 4 years has been being a part of something, and Ridgeview Alumni has been one of those big parts for me. I joined Alumni because I heard it was free, and I was completely broke when I got here to Ridgeview, and that's why I started coming. And immediately I found just a community and people that welcomed me like no other. And many blessings have come from alumni, but one of the biggest things is, you know, Joe was doing his service work on the very first AA meeting that I walked into in Cottage C here in Detox. That was my very first AA meeting, and he was there telling his story. And I say this every Wednesday, but I didn't know he had the big book, and he was talking about the steps, and he was talking about all this stuff. I didn't know what that was, but I knew that I wanted the freedom that he was talking about. I was completely desperate to do anything to have that freedom from alcohol. And one of the biggest gifts that I have been given is to do those meetings with Joe every Wednesday for the patients here. I get to do that. And I don't know if that's like the big thing that keeps me sober. Maybe it's the only thing that keeps me sober. I don't know. But I try to never miss that meeting, because I have to see my people that pick up white chips and 30-day chips and 60-day chips. Because the minute I forget that, I'm in the red zone. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. And Eddie, I love you. I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 2nd, 2017. I have a sponsor who knows, I think, that she sponsors me. I talk to her at least every week. I sponsor other ladies in this program, which has been a huge blessing for me. My home group is the Searchers Group here in Smyrna, and we meet on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Fridays at 11:30, and that's been a big part. That's my home group, and I love those guys. A lot of those people are here tonight. So, yeah, I mean, August 2nd, let's take it back there. I'm from Anniston, Alabama. I guess I feel like I have to, anybody from Anniston, Alabama? Yes, okay, I have to ask that every time I give out the chips. But yeah, I'm from Anniston, Alabama. I have two amazing folks that have been married a long time. You know, grew up in a great household, rarely alcohol in the home. I have an older brother that's 5 years older than me, kind of always protected me, just great home life. My first drink, like most of you guys, was age 14. And I don't remember much about that first drink other than when I consumed that alcohol, it took me away. I was age 14, and it took me away from everything that was going on inside of me. That painful insecurity, that fear, that, you know, everything that was going on inside of me that I thought was wrong and bad, and I just was never comfortable in my skin. What that first drink did for me was take me out of here and take me there, take me with you guys. And that is what I would chase for the rest of my drinking career. Every single drink that I would have after that, that was my purpose, to take it out of me and get over there. Like I said, I don't remember much about that night. And I think Wild Turkey was involved and a lot of throwing up, and you guys know how it was. But that was always, you know, I didn't drink to, you know, to have a few drinks and to loosen up. I drank when I realized that it would take me there. I drank to get there, and whatever I had to do to get there, and it usually ended up in blackouts and bad things happening. And that was the way that my drinking career went. Cliff notes, because I know you guys like the shorter, easier, softer way. I'll save you a lot of time. You know, in my 20s, my drinking was a lot of fun until it wasn't. That's the best way to describe it. My drinking was, you know, I was young, it was fun, it would start out really fun. I was the life of the party, I was loud, I was this, I was that, until I hit that brick wall. And things got bad. You know, I would steal your keys off the kitchen counter and wreck your car in the driveway, or steal your boyfriend. That was always a favorite. You know, it was a lot of fun until it just wasn't. And I remember, you know, being in my 20s and people meeting me, like, for the first time, before I started drinking that night, and then the next morning they were like, who was that person? You know, what I'm seeing now sober doesn't even match the person that you showed yesterday when you were drunk. And that's kind of how, I mean, that's how I was. You know, I would drink to black out, and I would become this evil, nasty, loud, horrible person. And I just couldn't understand that, right? And in my 20s, it was easy to get away with because, you know, you're cute, you're fun, you're whatever. My 30s were, oh shit, she's got a problem. How do we cover this up? Like, how do we cover this up? The secrets kind of started getting out. Consequences really started happening in my 30s. I was blessed enough to find a husband who drank like me. He was my second husband, and he drank like me. But he was one of those that could kind of control it. You know, he could, like, keep it together out in public and, like, keep the image up. And so, you know, immediately he figured out you know, how I was drinking. I mean, I think it took like the second date and he was like, oh my God, what are we going to do with this? You know? And so that was our relationship. You know, my things started happening. Consequences started happening. DUIs started happening. The great part in my 30s was that we had two children together. We had two little babies, 2 years apart. That was the blessing in my 30s. And I would want to stand up here and say that that maybe got me sober for a little bit, got me sober for 9 months, but it didn't. I found a doctor on my first pregnancy. I found a doctor in Atlanta. It was like in a doctor's practice of like six doctors. And I found the one doctor. I went to all six of them, and I found that one doctor, Dr. Rosenberg, and he was an older dude, and I'm sitting there, I'm like 3 months pregnant, and I said, so, like, he's telling me, like, what to eat, and I'm like, so when it comes to, like, a glass of wine, can I drink alcohol? Can I have a glass of wine? And he kind of looked at me and he's looking at my husband like, he was like, well, you know, one glass a week wouldn't hurt. I mean, it's not recommended, but it wouldn't hurt. And, you know, that's all I heard. It will not hurt. And so I took it from there. And, you know, I continued to drink during my pregnancy. And by the grace of God, my two daughters are wonderful and no health problems. But anyway, yeah, I was lucky enough at the time to have a husband that just covered it up. His goal, you know, his thing was, you know, how do we fix this? Like, how do we keep this thing pretty and hide what's going on? You know, at this time we had the big shiny house and the big shiny stuff and all the shiny stuff, and things were completely out of control. The more he tried to control and the more I tried to control and more I tried to do this and that, and we tried everything in the book to control my drinking. We tried Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you just drink beer. Thursday and Friday you can have Tuesday and Thursday you can have liquor drinks. That didn't work. Okay, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday we'll you know, change to vodka drinks, and then we tried every piece to try to control my drinking, and it, you know, it just wouldn't work. And the more I tried to do that, the worse it got. You know, a big part of my story, and I think one of the main reasons I'm here, my husband came downstairs. My husband at the time came downstairs. It was about 2015. And like I said, things just really, really started happening. I was getting in a habit of, you know, joyriding, drinking and driving with my kids. You know, I thought that was fun. That was a fun afternoon. And then I would get blacked out and get my kids in the back of the car and drive downtown. And things were just getting really bad. And it was about 6:30 one morning. It was about 2015. And it was about 6:30 in the morning. I remember it like it was yesterday. And he comes downstairs and I'm packing my kids' school lunch and I'm in the kitchen. And he comes downstairs and said, you need to call your mom and dad, your family. It's time to call your family. You're going to need some help because I'm out. And he was standing there in the kitchen, and through past his vision or past him, I could see his bar past the kitchen, and it was fully stocked. And it wasn't the first time that I had drank in the morning, that's for sure. I was a big fan of Hair of the Dog, you know, on a Saturday morning, the Sunday morning. But that particular morning at 6:30 in the morning, when he left, I went right over to the bar and I poured a big glass of vodka, you know. And that would become my routine for the next 2 years. I couldn't get out of the bed without a bottle next to me. I couldn't go to sleep without passing out. And that was my routine. I spent the next, 6 months pawning every shiny thing that I owned, pawning my kids' things. We luckily were able to sell the house, but we lost the cars. Everything that I thought was important to me was gone. And it was out of control. I was completely out of control. And I remember thinking, like, you know, I couldn't live without the alcohol inside of me. And I was drinking and it was working. Like, my family was there and they came immediately that day and they couldn't understand what was going on. People were so baffled because we had kept this huge secret from most of the outside. You know, immediate friends and people that we'd try to have over for parties, of course, knew. But we tried so hard to keep this secret and people were like, what the hell's going on? My family just couldn't understand, like, you know, what an asshole this guy is, you know? And it was perfect for me because he did look like the asshole, you know? And it was poor, pitiful me, drink, you know? Because look at all these things that are happening to me. I've lost everything. Who would not be drinking the way I'm drinking right now? And I just to give you an example, since I'm going to get y'all in the Christmas spirit, okay? Let me go ahead and let me start with some of the stories. I've got tons of them, and they could go for hours, but I won't do that because we're on limited time. It was probably the last Christmas before I decided to get sober, and my daughters and I were living in a my ex had moved us into a one bedroom home, and my daughters and I are there, and this is just how I was functioning, and I thought this was normal. Like I at this point I just thought everything I did was normal. And Christmas is big in my family, and it was Christmas Eve. I had no money whatsoever. My parents had bought my children a bunch of gifts, and they had brought them over a few days before and said, wrap these and put them under the tree to have something for the girls to wake up to. And so Christmas Eve, I'm like decorating this tree and like everything's in shambles and my kids are there. You know, I don't know if you guys have done this, but I'm playing Christmas music. I'm getting in the Christmas spirit. I put the kids down to sleep and I just start getting happy. Like, I have a bottle of vodka and I am just like, I'm going to wrap these presents. I'm singing Christmas carols. You know, my clothes are starting to come off and I'm like, you know, trying to have fun. And next thing I know, I wake up and it's Christmas Day and nothing is wrapped. Everything in shambles. The Christmas tree is like laying on the floor, like it's in complete shambles. And, you know, my kids are like, you know, Santa didn't even come this year. And so the worst nightmare, this happened a lot, but I don't know if you guys can relate, but that morning when I woke up, I knew I had not left enough for the next day. I drank everything that I had that night, having fun and partying by myself, right? And I could just feel my skin, you know, burning. Just the thought of not having enough, and it's Christmas Day, and so we didn't have a car, and it's raining outside, and I had, trying to carry on the Christmas tradition. Bought my kids and myself onesies, Christmas onesies. And they're in cute little Santa onesies, and I'm in the Grinch onesie, which is like really fitting at the time. I'm in this, you know. And I'm like, kids, stay here. Mommy's going to fix all of this. She's got it under control. And I call an Uber, and I had to get some alcohol. I mean, that was my first thought. I don't know. It was like, it was early in the morning. It was probably 8 o'clock in the morning. And the Uber comes, and she gets a flat tire. And we're living off of busy street in Marietta off of Powers Ferry, and she gets a flat tire, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, my kids are inside, they're at home, and I'm like, Lord help. And so screw this, I get out of the car, it's pouring down rain, and I am and I'm on Powers Ferry Road. If you guys know where that is, it's like a pretty busy road, and I see all these people jogging, and they're like in these marathon, like with their numbers, and they're running down Powers Ferry, and I'm in my Grinch onesie, and I'm like, oh my God, they're running. Okay, so I'm gonna start running. You know, I'm running with them, pouring down rain. I'm completely drenched. Everything looks horrible. And I'm getting to the BP there on the corner. And I knew my liquor store was closed across the street, but this BP was going to be my winning station. And I'm running up to that gas station. And as I'm getting up into the parking lot, I can see there's like paper over where the wine and the beer is. You know, I couldn't read what it said, but you know, I get in, and I'm like drenching wet, and I'm like, you know, and they weren't selling alcohol. And, you know, I don't know if you guys can relate, but like, I can still feel my skin, you know, the way that I felt. And it was like, Jesus. And so I ran back home, and, you know, just nothing in my hands, and I'm drenching wet, and I'm like, go through, you know, walk through the doors, and my kids are like, what the hell? You know, I'm drenched wet in this Grinch outfit, and that was normal for me. You know, those little girls were sitting there waiting for their gifts, and the story goes on. You know, I mean, I was able to get alcohol from my neighbor and wrap the gifts, and like I kind of mended it up, and the girls swear that they don't resent me for that today. You know, we kind of laugh about it now, but that was normal for me. That was just like a normal day. And then the next day, something else happened like that, and it just continued, and it continued, and it continued. And then let me tell you, I mean, I've got some stories, but you know, the August 2nd, I'd like to say that I have a great story and that something horrible, horrible happened. I mean, there were some things leading up to it. I did lose my children about three weeks before I decided to come in here. I broke into a house. You guys know that story. I won't go into that, but I broke into a townhouse and because I knew there was some alcohol in there, and I got busted, and there were some cameras, and it was all caught on camera. And that next morning I wake up and there's my ex-husband had printed the pictures. They have found, you know, found him to whatever, and he had printed the pictures and set them in the home that I was living in, and he said, you know, the kids are gone, they're done. I mean, they're, you know, he took them because they were in the back seat when I went to break into the house. And I remember waking up that morning and seeing those pictures and not really thinking much of it other than the girls were gone. Their stuff was gone. Their little bags were gone. And I remember thinking, thank God. Like, thank God. Now I can drink the way that I want to. There's nobody. My kids were like my last straw. That was my thing. Like, at least I'm still a mom. Like, at least I'm still a good parent. you know. And when they were gone, that was the last thing, literally the last thing that could have been taken from me. And I just remember, like, thank God, let me drink the way that I want to. I was going around my neighborhood and, you know, knocking on doors, asking people to do their laundry just for $5, so I could get to the liquor store and walk to the liquor store, have somebody drive me to the liquor store, like, just to get money. And so I did that for, like, at least 3 weeks. I drank like that, just by myself. And at this time, everybody had stopped taking my calls. Even my brother, who has always been my saving grace and the one I call when I get a DUI or anything, he had stopped taking my calls. And I did that for a solid 3 weeks until August 2nd. I said, you know what? I'm completely out of money. I really have no other way to get cash to get to the liquor store. I can't. There's nothing else for me to do. I was stone cold sober. I woke up and there was nothing else left for me to do. And I called, you know, my father, and I said, the gig's up pretty much. Like, there's not, you know, I need to go get some help, I guess. And that's what I did. You know, my mom picked me up. I had to go into CVS because I didn't have feminine products and, like, all that stuff. And I didn't have any money to my name. And I said, can I just have $20 to go in here and get some toothpaste or something? And she said, no, I'll go in and get it for you. She didn't even trust me with anything. They were so disappointed. And just the look in my parents' eyes and the look in my kids' eyes, like, it's just, you know, it's something I can't forget, and I hope not to forget. And so anyway, that's when my journey started. I was sitting in the access center for about 8 hours. And when I was there in that access center, and I had lost everything had been crushed to a million pieces when I was sitting there. And I had no clue that it was Jen that was the cause of that. I just remember thinking, like, this is not fair. I'm 39 years old. This is all because of my ex-husband. This is because of my dad, who stopped taking my calls. This is because of my brother. This is because of my neighbors. This is because of my friends who stopped taking my calls. This is all because of everybody else. Like, you know, and I had no clue that it was me that was the problem. And, you know, I'm stone cold sober, and this guy named Steve comes up to me, and he's working in the access center, and he's like, look, you never have to drink again. And he's, like, kneeling next to me, like, we're about to pray or something. And I was like, what the fuck? This dude is really telling me? Like, I'm like, all right. So I saw somebody standing at the bus stop down here on South Cobb. Like, how quick can I get out of here? Like, are they going to shoot me if I try to run? Will they try to cuff me? Like, you know, put the needle in my back or something like I see on TV? But when he said that, I was like, oh my God, because the thought of me never picking up another drink again, I couldn't comprehend it. My life revolved for the past 20 years around this alcohol. And the thought of me ever, like, and I remember thinking, so my daughters were 6 and 8 at the time when I got sober. And I remember thinking, like, no, Steve, because listen, I've got 2 daughters that are going to get married. And how am I going to have a champagne toast at their wedding? Like, I've got to be there to rep, you know. And it's like, that's 25 years down the road, but that's how my thinking was. And it was just so, you know, I was so broken, and I had no idea how broken I was. So they take me back, and they, first 10 minutes, a guy named Patrick takes me into this room, and he's like, you're going into an AA room. Oh, and Steve was like, yeah, you're going to a cottage. Like, you're going to be, because I was like, am I going to be safe? Like, you know, I brought my tennis skirt. Like, I'd already, like, Googled everything, and I saw a nice pool, and I brought my, actually, I brought, like, 5 tennis skirts, 2 hair dryers, a straightening iron, what else did I bring? Like a sequins top, because I thought maybe we were going to have a dance or something. And, you know, I had 2 suitcases. And, Steve is like, yeah, you're going to the cottage. Once you get back there, they're going to take you to a cottage. And I'm like, oh, my God, yeah, this is totally my speed. This is me. And it wasn't that at all. But in detox, the first 10 minutes, this guy named Patrick takes me into a room, and it's an AA meeting. And I hope I never forget that meeting, because, like I said, Joe was there and Blessing was there, and they were doing their service work, and they were bringing a meeting in there. And there were about 20 people in that meeting and in that detox with me. And immediately what started happening was people started sharing. And people started sharing about, like, their kids. And there was a mother in there. There was actually 5 mothers in there with children. And there was a guy who was 18 years old next to me who was a heroin addict. And he was doing things that I was doing when I was drinking. And he was talking about this stuff. And everybody was sharing about my story. Like, they were telling my story, this thing that I had kept for so long. Like, these moms were talking about how they were hiding liquor bottles in the soccer bags and the water bottles and da-da-da-da. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm home. I'm home. I found my people. And I will never forget that feeling, because, you know what? That feeling has never left me. Every single time I walk into a meeting, I hear you guys saying what I'm thinking, or what I was thinking, or when I was in my car and I thought I had 20 problems. You guys are telling me how to solve these problems. And I just remember saying, okay, I'm going to share, but I'm not going to say that I'm an alcoholic. Because Lord knows, that's not me. I just have a drinking problem. I want them to, like, show me how to drink 2 glasses of wine on the patio when I get out of here. And I'm not going to say it. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. And I shared, and I couldn't shut up. Every single meeting, I mean, Mary Jean knows that. Like, first Friday, and Perry, like, I could not shut up my first year of sobriety. Like, I'd go in, and I was like, I had diarrhea of the mouth. And then I did this. And you guys are, like, shaking your head, like, yeah. Like, join the club. We did, too. And it was a journey. And so anyway, I get out of detox, and I thought I was cured. I'd 5 days sober, and I'd get on the phone and want to start making all my amends. But what I will say, I Uber picked me up from here at Ridgeview, and when I get in my car, it had been 5 days. I was away from everything and everybody. And I plug in my car in Uber, and I turn it on, and there was not one missed call. There was not one text message. There was not one voicemail. You know, and that's how it stayed for a while. And I just remember thinking, damn, like, nobody even knew I was gone. Like, it was pretty. And so, you know, that night, immediately, I went home. I didn't stay at the residence. I now, looking back, I think it would have been much easier if I did, but I went home. And what started happening was, somebody who I went to detox with called me that night, and my ex-husband was in the car in the Uber when we were going home, and he had to stop at the liquor store and get his 5 o'clock. You know, he was having his drink regardless. And I remember sitting in Uber when he went into that liquor store in Concord Road. And I remember him like looking at him like, okay, I knew exactly where he was going. And I knew that I could convince him to get me some alcohol. Like I knew it. Like I had been 5 days sober. He was like, you know, shit, let me just take this girl, let me just get her somewhere, drop her off. And I knew that I knew that there was a way that I could get alcohol. And what happened in that that night before I'd left detox, I had promised a girl that I would make it to the Sunday night speaker meeting that we used to have here in this auditorium. And I promised her, and we loved each other. You know how like you meet these people in detox and they're forever friends. And I promised her, and she was like, you have to, she's staying at residence. And I thought, oh my God, I can't get drunk before I go to that meeting. Like, I cannot get drunk, or I can't drink and go to where I just got out of detox. Like, let me just hold this thought until tomorrow. I'll drink tomorrow, but tonight I'm just going to get to that meeting with Marianne and sit there. And that's what I did. I went from that liquor store, I went home, I changed my clothes, I got in an Uber, and I came here. And that's where I met my first sponsor. She was telling her story. And, Marianne was like, that's your sponsor. Go ask her. And I'm like, I'm not asking a woman to, like, And I did. I just took the advice, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And I thank God for that, because she said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to call me every day at this time. And these are the meetings you're going to. You're going to go to a meeting every single day. Call me when you get home. Because I said, I pass 3 liquor stores from here to my home, and they're all my liquor stores. And so how do I get from here to there, 2.5 miles, without telling Uber to pull into that liquor store? She's like, this is what you're going to do, okay, honey? And she's like, you're going to call me. You're going to stay on the phone with me until you get home. Then you're going to call me when you get in bed. Then you're going to call me in the morning. And I thought, ugh, like, that's so uncomfortable for me, because I'm not a woman girl. I don't like to talk to, at that time, I didn't like to talk to anybody. But that lady was telling her, was talking in that first meeting, and I knew that I wanted the freedom that she had and that Joe had. And I was willing to do whatever she was going to say, and I was a little scared of her too. She's this little thing, and so that's what I did. That's what I did every single day, and I just followed along. And she told me, "Listen, you're 60 days. You're going to start doing this detox meeting with the patients, and this." And I'm like, "That's ridiculous. I'm not even sober yet. Like, I'm 60 days sober. Nobody wants to hear from me." And I just did. I just did. I took this out of this, and I just did what you guys suggested. I was willing, and things continued to crash around me. I was lucky enough to get my girls back, but DFAX came and visited me here in detox, and I'll never forget, like, Eddie coming to me and bringing me back, and I'm like, what do I do? What do I say? And he turns his name tag around, and he's like, yet, he's talking about the yet, and I'm like, what the hell, the yet? I'm like, what? And he's like, you go in there, and you be honest, and just be yourself, and it's all going to be okay. And he was a complete stranger to me, but for some reason, I believed him. I believed what he was saying, and that's exactly what I did, and it turned out okay. I just started doing this thing. The first year, it just was action. It was doing. It was a shit show. It was all these things wrapped into one great feeling of being loved. I mean, it's the first time in my life I've ever felt that I felt fit in. Things started like happening, and like confidence and weird stuff started happening. And what I thought that first year was that I was going to be able to like pull together all those million pieces that were broken in that access center that were all around me broken. I thought I was going to be able to like put those like back together, right? I was like, well, I'm going to get the husband back. Then I'm going to get the car back. Then we're going to get the house back. And then we're going to get like the family back. And then we're all going to get everything back. That's all I wanted to do. And, you know, I had no idea that I would not pick up any of those pieces. But you guys would show me how to pick up like new pieces and start putting like my own pieces back together. So that first year was crazy. I got a little job and at a gym, and I've always loved to work out, and got a job, part-time job at a little gym down the street, and took Uber there and had to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning, work until 1 o'clock, got off at 1 o'clock, picked up my kids, washed, at this gym. I washed sweaty, dirty, da-da-da-da stuff, but I was busy. I was busy, and I was seeing tons of people come in and talking, and it was like the mood was light, and that's what I did. 5 to 1, you know, and then one, I'd pick up my kids from off the school bus, and we'd go in, and then I'd get to a meeting, and then I'd get to another meeting, and my ex-husband would come over, and he would keep the girls while I went to a meeting, and you know, and so that's what I did, and I just kept on just doing the thing and started meeting some great people. And So the first year, anybody who's like within those 60 days or 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, like that's the reason I'm standing up here tonight, are the people that pick up those chips, because it's tough. It's tough. And, you know, I just had to keep on doing what you guys said. And I was just kind of going through, and then realized that the marriage wasn't going to work, and my sponsor was like, listen, you have to wait a year to do this thing called divorce. And I did. I waited 14 months, and I did all the things to take me through that, and things started coming back together. And I started working these steps, and I won't go through all of them, but, step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So with my higher power, I'd be a little weird not to talk about that, because it's a huge thing in my sobriety. But with my higher power thing, I grew up an Episcopalian, and it was all very confusing to me. Like we weren't super religious in the house, but we went to church on Sunday, and my parents didn't push it, whatever. And so my thinking of a God was very like weird. I didn't know, like somebody in the sky looking after me, and sometimes I'd pray. Usually when I prayed and asked God for something, I was like in the back of Fulton County police car, like, Jesus, God. No, I was more like this. Can you please, I'll do anything. I will do anything if you can just get, I swear to God, I'll never drink another sip of alcohol if you can just get me out of this. So those were my prayers, you know. So the, like, turning my will over to this higher power was very uncomfortable, like uncomfortable. It didn't make any sense to me, right? And I remember walking my dogs in my neighborhood, and I don't know, I was like 4 months sober, and my sponsor and I were like at step three, and I was like, yeah, I believe, like, let's get to step four, whatever. Like, I wanted to do like step one, and then I wanted to go to step four, and then I wanted to do step eight. Like, I wanted to hop around, and luckily she kept me on track with that. But I remember like walking my dogs and thinking about this higher power, like something greater than myself, and my dogs are like pulling towards a squirrel, like really hard, more than normal. And I'm like, oh my God, maybe the squirrels, like wildlife, is my higher power. You know, my dogs talk to, you know, like I talk to them, and I was really confused about it. But you guys just kept on telling me, like, don't think so much about it. Like, don't think so much about it. And I was in a women's meeting here on Saturday morning. And I was about 9 months sober, and I was in this women's meeting, incredible women's meeting here that they have here at the hospital. And a woman shared, Ellen shared, and she was talking about her higher power. And she said, you know, she was talking, you know, she was like, if you need a higher power, you can borrow mine. Like, you can borrow mine if you don't know what that looks like. And she said, my higher power speaks through the people in these rooms. Like, what I think of my higher power, and she didn't go into detail, but she said, my higher power speaks through the shares in these rooms, in my AA meetings. And at 9 months sober, I could relate to that. Because up until that, every single meeting I had been going to twice a day, to that 9 month period, I could relate to that. Because every single time I walked into an AA meeting, you guys were talking about, just like that first meeting I went to, you guys were talking about what I was thinking or what I'd been dealing with that week, or the ex-husbands and the ex-wives and doing all this stuff. And so I could relate to that. And that's where I guess I was sold on the higher power thing. And it started to make sense. And, you know, it really didn't make sense, but it kind of made sense, you know. And I just did these steps. I did these steps, and my sponsor and I did them, and it took us about a year to get through them, and things started happening, and life started happening, and I don't know, I've kind of lost train of thought, but I'll kind of jump around, but, you know, I was about 3 years sober, and really cool stuff started, like, had already started to happen. You know, my kids were happy. I had my children. Family was kind of coming around. My dad still has, I asked him today, like, you still haven't given me the code to their house, like, you know, but things started coming around. I was invited for Thanksgiving dinner, let's put it that way. He's like, you're never getting the code to that garage door ever again. And that's okay. But, and so things, cool stuff started happening. I don't know how, but I just kept doing the things. And by 3 years sober, you guys had taught me like this routine. I'd get pieces of what you guys were talking about in the meetings, and I would try them. Prayer and meditation early in the morning, I don't know about that, but I was already getting up early because of this little job that I had the first year of sobriety. And so I started trying it, and it was like working. And then somebody said, like, hit your knees the first thing in the morning and say your prayers. Try it that way. And then, like, even cool stuff, more cool stuff started happening, and things started coming back together in a different way. I was able to, you know, get a home for me and my children that's a mile from the mental hospital here. And my parents were like, Because I'm like, I've got to stay in this area, like right here, very close to Ridgeview, because I got to get to my meetings and I got to get to Tillman. And my parents are like, so you're basing where you buy a house from the mental hospital you went to? And I'm like, yes, yes. And so anyway, cool stuff started happening. And so I was sitting in a meeting. I'm sorry if I jumped around, but I was sitting in a meeting, my home group meeting on Saturday morning. It's a 12 and 12. You guys, this meeting is incredible. It completely shifts my entire week when I'm in this meeting with these people. And we were on step 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And we were on step 9. And now I had already started, I had done my amends. Like when we got to step 9 with my sponsor that first year, I started, and my very first amends was with my first ex-husband. And it was just like the weirdest thing. He ended up calling after like 2 years, and his mom had died of alcoholism, and he wanted to tell me about it. And he called, and I'm in my kitchen, and I made my amends to him, you know. And it was the most beautiful organic thing, and such a beautiful relationship has come from that, and him with my family. And it's a real cool story. But I had already started making the amends, right, and doing the amends, and it's a lifelong thing, and everything was going great. I was 3 years sober, and things started coming back. It was this nagging thing that everything was great. It was just like this thing with this second ex-husband. I had so much resentment towards him, and you know, like, how could he ever do those things to me? Like, he was the one that crashed all this stuff, and he was supposed to be supporting me and helping me, and we had to take the kids out of private school, and like all this stuff. And I just couldn't. And my sponsor, I changed sponsors because I found a sponsor in my home group who's much closer, and it's a beautiful relationship. But my now sponsor said, just wait, you don't have to do the amends to him. And so I'm in my Saturday meeting, and it's during COVID, you know. It's like we had our first in-person meeting and we're sitting there. There are like 6 of us, and it's on step 9, and a friend of mine, sorry, he's sitting right there, so it makes it awkward. A friend of mine shares, and if you know about Tony Shares, I don't mean to break anonymity, but if you've ever been in a room with Tony Shares, you know what I'm talking about. He was talking about step 9, and he was talking about the freedom that step 9 had given him. He was talking about amends with his ex-wife, and how it was like this beautiful thing, and it opened up this relationship, and it freed him. He was doing those amends to like clean his side of the street. Not like going to, for me, it wasn't about anymore going to my ex-husband like and apologizing for like his stuff, right? Because we both had like all this stuff. We had so much stuff. And so I left that meeting. I left that meeting and went, it was a Saturday, and went through my normal routine. I've got a very cool routine on Saturday, and I'm in the grocery store, and my purse is in the buggy, and I pick up my phone. I don't even know, I wasn't even thinking about it. I wasn't even thinking about any, you know, and by the grace of God, I just pick up my phone and I dial my ex-husband, and I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And he said, that's all I wanted to hear. You know, that's all I wanted to hear. And you know, I had to take it back a little bit. I mean, we had a super toxic relationship. Like I said, we both drank, and I'd always throw the first punch, but he would hit harder, and it was just a really toxic relationship. But you know, a few months before, which didn't make anything easier, he had come to pick. He gets the girls on the weekends, and he had come to pick up the girls on a Friday afternoon, and my big book was sitting on the counter in my kitchen, and he was like, "You are not working this program because you have not made the amends to me," you know. And I was like, "I'm gonna kill this motherfucker." And so I don't know, you know, talking about the power of a share, in that women's meeting, that's, you know, with a higher power, where I just walked out and I'm like, I get it now. And talking about the power, you know, the power of that share that Tony shared that day. And I just picked up the phone, and what happened with that amends that day in the grocery store, almost immediately what happened was we were able, my ex-husband and I were able to mend this like bridge with each other. We were I don't know how to explain it, but things were just kind of like, you know, and almost actually immediately, you know, it was a Saturday, and Sunday, he keeps my girls on the weekends. On Sunday, he called, and we went through this weird thing. Like, my kids don't eat my food. They hate my cooking. You guys know I'm a horrible cook. But they eat his cooking, and that made me hate him even more. They eat whatever he puts on the plate, you know, and of his. And so he said, you know, Ella's, and why don't you come upstairs? The girls are here, and I'm going to show you exactly how to make like 5 meals. And I did. That's what I did that Sunday. That was the next day after that happened in that grocery store. And my youngest daughter was, we were virtual learning and virtual at home, and my youngest daughter was struggling with her grades and doing the virtual thing, and we were able to go to family, you know, together. We were able to go to meetings with the teachers, and we were just able to like do a family dinner and like do all these things. And so, yeah, it was just it just kind of bridged that gap. And then 8 months from that day that I was standing in that grocery store, he calls me and he said, "Something's not right. Can you drive me? It was a Friday. I'm supposed to pick up the girls at 5, but can you come and pick me up? I can't drive." And I did, and I took him to the emergency room. And 48 hours, he was dead. Because of, you know, I think it's a God thing, but because, you know, we kind of mended those things. I mean, we weren't 100%, of course, but we were able just to be around each other. But, you know, he put me as an emergency contact in the emergency room. He put my name and my telephone number and nobody else's. And the doctor called me and said, he's got 48 hours to live. You know, you're the ex-wife, so you can't make the decisions, but you need to call his family. And his family, you know, is in Europe. And I was able to go up to the hospital because my name was on that emergency contact. And he was in deep, he wasn't, you know, he was not there. And they were just keeping him alive. But I was able, what happened was when I went up to the hospital, when that doctor called me, it was 1:30 in the morning, and the first thing I did was, you know, I got out my phone and I started making my amends to him. All the things that I had planned to tell him, and all the things that I had done wrong, I'd put into my phone, and I went up to the hospital and I sat, and I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know what to do. And I called my people. And thank God for COVID, because I jumped on a meeting at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I got on a meeting on my earphones on the way to the hospital, and I just needed to hear you guys say the promises and read the readings and share a little bit maybe. And I sat in that hospital room, and what happened was I was able to be of service, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I was able to, you know, I just kept asking God just to guide me. God, just guide me. God, just guide me. Just guide me. And what happened was, like, you know, I was able to put FaceTime with his mom and his sister and his family back home. I was able to put, you know, the FaceTime up to his ear, and he had a reaction, you know, and his mom. And so I was able to do that, and I promised myself I would not leave that room until I felt like that everything was going to be okay, and that I felt it through him. And I would sit there, and I would sit there, and I would sit there, and I was like waiting for an answer. I was waiting for, like, God to, like, shoot down from that hospital room and say everything was going to be okay. And I logged on to a meeting, and it was about surrender. And, you know, it was those shares, and I got off that meeting, and I said my prayer, and I said a prayer to him, and I knew when I said goodbye to him, when I was walking out of that hospital room and down the hall into the parking lot, something just, like, I was floating. I don't even remember walking to my car, but I knew everything was going to be okay. And And I got into a meeting in the car. And then when I got home, I got onto another meeting. And then when I got that night, I came here and came to a meeting. And I just did that. And my daughters were on spring break. They didn't even know anything. And they were on spring break. And I had to figure out a way to tell them when they got home in 2 days that their daddy had passed and died. And they didn't get to, you know, they didn't get to say goodbye. They didn't know what was going on. And I asked you guys, what do I do? And I went to Joe's house, and everybody was, you know, and they sat with me, and you guys just sat with me, you know, and I never felt alone. And you guys said, you're going to go home, and you're going to get those little girls, and you're going to be honest with them, and you're going to tell them what happened. Because me, I wanted the easier, softer way. I actually, like, I talked to my dad. I'm like, Dad, can you, like, tell them while I go away for a few days? You know, but I didn't. I didn't do that. And I did what I had to do. And I kept logging on to those meetings, and I kept on getting, the day of his funeral, that morning, I get on to a Thursday meeting in my home group, and I just listened to you guys, and I just, you guys had to be there. And all this shit, this stuff that I had, for 3 years, I had talked all this crap about this guy, because I really wanted y'all to hate him as much as I hated him, you know, right? Like, I really want, and I talked all this crap, and they had asked my younger daughter to say a few, you know, to talk at his funeral. And Ella came to me, and she's the morning of, and she said, Mama, I can't do this. Can you do it for us? Can you do it for Mia? And can we just tell you the words to say at his funeral? And I did. I was able to stand up there. And when I got up there to that podium, I looked out, and you guys were sitting there at his funeral. I saw you guys. People had come out that hadn't even left their house during COVID, and they were sitting at his funeral. And I was like, this is crazy. And I y'all were there. And then an image I'll never forget is the next month after that, I would be coming home from work, and you guys, I would look on my camera in my driveway, and I would see you guys, some complete strangers, dropping off food at my door. Complete strangers, people in this meeting, people from AA, dropping off food for me and my daughters. Like, I don't know, like it just did something to me, you know? And you guys showed up, and you guys would come over to my house on Friday night and bring pizza and just be with me. Joe's laughing because, you know, that's what this program does for me. That's what my program does for me. Like, I haven't even done anything. Like, I just show up for the willingness to stay sober. I just wake up every morning and ask God, like, thank you for keeping me sober yesterday. Let me try to do the same thing today. And you guys would show up to my house and keep my kids while I went to a meeting, you know? And I was like, you know, I mean, and I didn't know how I was going to do life, you know, by myself. He was financially took care of my kids, and I just didn't know, and I just didn't know. And I was thinking, and I was, I was overthinking. And the minute I would start overthinking and, like, doubting things, and I can't do this, I cannot do this, I'd come to a meeting, and you guys say, you're not alone. You know, you're here. We're here for you. And that's what this program does for me. That's what this program does for my children. You know, my kids today, I've got a teenager, so she's hit or miss. But she's 13 and she's going on like 28. It's weird. But me and my girls we're our family, right? They know that they can come to me and that mommy's gonna be there, right? They know that mommy's gonna get up early in the morning, and they know when mommy needs to go to a meeting. My youngest one, you know, is like, mommy, time to go. Your Wednesday meeting is starting. It's time for you to go, you know, because they know when I come back, the way that I act. They don't know what happens in these meetings. They don't know what goes on. They don't know what AA is about. But to see this program work through them, especially through this death, and you know, this is just the start. There's going to be deaths. There's going to be stuff that happens to us every day. You know, but I know that I can come back to you guys no matter where I am, and that's what this program does. This is what the program does. The biggest, there's so many gifts, and I could stand up here forever and talk about, like, the gifts, and it's not the material stuff. That, like, the material stuff starts to come back, and, like, you get a job, and it's good, and you know, everything that I kind of got is through this program, my job, like, it's all linked to AA. But it's the relationships, the being able to sit with my father while he's in my house and just enjoy me. He said the biggest gift is just to watch you stay sober and to be sober and not to have to worry about you driving drunk with my granddaughters in the back downtown Atlanta or God knows where, taking them God knows where with men in the car and men in your home. That relationship, these relationships, the relationships, this program works through them. This program works through my coworkers. This program works through the lady at the cashier at Publix. You know, it just makes me a better person. You know, there are things that you guys taught me that I have to do every day, right? I have to pray and meditate. I have to do this on a daily basis. I have to get to my meetings. I have to talk to my sponsor. I have to exercise. That's my part of meditation, and pray for the people that haven't gotten this yet. I have to do some form of service work. One of the biggest gifts is working with women in this program that get it and that are willing to do the work. And that come and just say, listen, like, I need help. The biggest gift is having my name on that temporary sponsor list and helping women go through this program and maybe just like a little glimpse of the freedom that I have today. Anything can happen. Anything could happen tomorrow. Anything could happen tonight. But the freedom that I have from alcohol, the obsession to not have to drink that drink in the morning has been lifted, and that is a miracle for me. I'm able to get up in the morning, and I swear, I know this is cheesy, but I get up every morning, and the first thing I say, I hit my knees. There was this old guy, Ed, in my home group that said, you know, I've got bad knees. Like, if I can get on my knees, you can get on your knees and sit, you know, do your prayers. And I'm like, okay. And that's what I do. But the first thing I say is, thank you. Thank you, God, for keeping me sober another day. And it's a big change from why me. Every morning I'd wake up in my drinking days and say, why me? Why another day? Why do I have to live this life? Why me? Why me? Poor, pitiful me. And I can go right back to that place in a drop of a hat if I'm not doing the things that you guys tell me to do. It's a gift for me to be standing up here with the people I love so much that keep me sober every day, and to be sober today, just for today, because that's how you guys have taught me to do. And I'll end with this. I was sitting in I was listening to a speaker meeting a few years ago, and I will never forget that she ended with this. She said, the people of AA are like God's soldiers. We've all touched the gates of hell. Every one of us have touched the gates of hell, and we've came back with a purpose. Thank you for letting me share tonight. I love y'all.
That was awesome, Jen. Thank you very much, Jen. Appreciate that. Oh, that was awesome.